This is maybe the easiest talk to give because there's so much material. It's hard. The only hard part is to restrict myself to only 2 hours. To talk about these two saints of the church is a real joy. Because if we look back on the development of the Kodiak mission that came to Alaska with such high hopes of bringing the gospel and the Orthodox faith to Alaska, and then see how it wound up, seven, and in the end only one. The school that they intended to found never really got off the ground. They built one church. The head of the mission drowned, together with two other missionaries, Deacon Stephen and Hiram McMacari. Another one, very early on, was martyred, St. Juvenali. And it doesn't take long before this mission dwindles. It doesn't exactly live up to the high expectations with which it was launched. And yet, the one humble monk, Herman, probably made the most significant single contribution to the foundations of Orthodoxy in the New World of anyone. However, there were no clergy here. St. Herman was a monastic who had never been ordained. And in 1818, when the Russian-American Company applied for their new charter, and Tikhmenev wrote this whitewash job, The History of the Russian-American Company, which exists in English. Some publisher, I think in Canada, printed it some years ago. This history is not the history of the whole company or its whole beginning to end story. It's just the first years, the first 20 years, the Baranov years. Between Khlebnikov and Tikhmenev, we get a very positive view of both Baranov as a person and the company's activities as a corporation. And on the basis of this positive assessment, the Tsar awarded the company another 20-year charter, which turned out to be good, because by this time Baranov has retired, that was 1818, and died at sea, in fact. He never made it back to Russia. He died on board ship in the Indian Ocean and was buried at sea. At least there are no monuments to Baranov anywhere, except Sitka. 5 years ago in Sitka, some of the business community decided that Baranov Island should have a monument to Baranov. I don't know why. They erected a statue of him, kind of sitting down and pondering we don't know what. Rather disrespectfully, some other people deposited rows of toilet tissue by him. Although at least he's fully clothed. And at the unveiling, the tip of his nose had been removed. Rather strange defacing of public property. But you see, this is the Tlingit way of identifying a slave. And so the Tlingits were not too happy in Southeast Alaska about having a monument to Alexander Baranov. And so they snipped off his nose, like in the nursery rhyme. Actually, there were file marks around his neck. They were probably trying for the whole head. But I suspect a cruiser car came by at an inopportune time, and so they just settled for Mr. Baranov's nose. It's been replaced, and he still sits there. To make matters worse, they had to remove the Tlingit canoe, which sat in front of the Centennial Building, aside to make room for Mr. Baranov. So it was a kind of double insult to the native community, who weren't consulted, of course, about the appropriateness of such a monument. A friend of mine pointed out that there are no monuments to Hernando Cortez in Mexico, but we've got one of Alexander Baranov. And nevertheless, he died at sea. There's no monument. There's no grave obelisk, as there is for Shelikov in Irkutsk. There's no monument to him anywhere that I know, that I'm aware of in Russia. But with the closing of the Baranov era and the coming of Yanovsky, we have a new era dawning, an era in which the company will work to support the church. In fact, the new charter, the new incorporation, demands several new things of the company if they're going to retain their incorporation, their monopoly on the fur trade. Two things that are significant. One, children of mixed marriages are the responsibility of the company. The Russian-American company must educate children of mixed Siberian and Native unions. They're responsible for educating them, and then those who are so educated are then responsible back again to the company for so many years of service, a kind of indentured relationship. That's actually a positive thing because it means now schools will be founded and supplied, the buildings will be built, the teachers will be paid out of the company profits. Secondly, and more importantly, The company is also responsible for the erection of and the support of churches, church buildings, and church clergy, and their transport to and from Russia. Without this support, the company doesn't get their charter, so of course they agree and they sign on the dotted line. Unalaska is the largest settlement in the Aleutian Islands, and there's a small chapel there, but no priest. Father Makary passed through in the late 1700s, but no one has been back since. So a call goes out, this is the early 1820s, will some bishop from some diocese somewhere in Siberia please send a priest, recruit a volunteer for the frontier? And much to everyone's surprise, the valedictorian of his graduating class, Ioan Popov, volunteers. We have to talk about Ioan Popov. It's the same man as Veniaminov. Ioan is John. It was spelled that way. And his last name was Popov. We should talk about Russian last names briefly. Surnames were not used. They were not in use in Russia until the time of Peter the Great's westernization program. And then he decided we have to be modern. We have to do things the way the West does it. People need last names. Someday we're going to need a phone directory. And what will we do without last names? So they assigned surnames to people by class, by economic and social caste, because everyone was also given a rank, not just in the government, but in any profession. You could be butcher, baker, or candlestick maker, ranks 1 through 12. This is, by the way, why the Russian Church has so many awards for its clergy, silver crosses, gold crosses, jeweled crosses, things to hang on this side and things to hang on that side, hats of different shapes and sizes. And it all comes from Peter the Great giving these promotions, which at least in Russia meant a pay increase. In this country, all we get is hats. But there was status to this, because you then knew if you were in the middle management in your profession or one of the top guys. And that's why making Bishop Yoasaf a bishop put him at rank equal to a governor. And it would have been a major improvement of situation in Kodiak if Bishop Yoasaf of Kodiak had arrived at his see. That didn't happen, as we know. But it's this ranking and then these last names. Clergy were assigned the last names of major feast days, you see? So you have somebody whose last name is Rojestvensky. It means Christmas. You have somebody named John Christmas. But it's obvious that at the time of the last names, when they were assigned, this man was from a clerical background. So Voznesensky, same thing, Ascension. And so, and Voskresensky, Pascha, resurrection. You could tell the higher ranking clergy got sort of first picks of major feasts. Then for some reason, they ran out of major feasts and there were too many names left over. So the middle management clergy got the names of birthstones. So you have the equivalent of pearl and ruby and aquamarine. And these are also clergy names. And then those were all left over. The readers and the subdeacons and, you know, people of low rank in the hierarchy of the church got Popov. So Ioan Popov in the seminary was probably the single most common name. There were like a dozen of them. Because anybody from the lower ranks of the clergy or descended therefrom, and the last names had only been handed out in the same century, earlier in the 18th century, there were so many Ioan Popovs. Now suddenly you have a valedictorian, the head of his class, who's got this most common name of all possible names. So they decided to award him not only whatever blue ribbons or gold medals he qualified for academically, but to change his name, which was no big thing because no one was particularly attached to their last name, but they'd just been handed out two generations before. The recently deceased bishop of Irkutsk was Veniamin. And so it's easy to remember then how Ioan Popov became Ioan Veniaminov. He was given, and sometimes he even wrote his name and was known as Popov-Veniaminov. But Ioan Popov is, you know, like I said, such a common name. They tried to distinguish him. And this Ioan Veniaminov was destined, they hoped, for a scholarship to go to the St. Petersburg Theological Academy. The hope was that he would go as their top student to Europe and study for basically his doctorate and come back and probably serve either as a major cleric in the diocese of Irkutsk or possibly teach in the theological faculty. He married soon after graduation, and when the word went out that they needed a priest for Alaska, he volunteered. The bishop did his best to dissuade him. Not you, You know, there are lots of other Yuan Popovs we'd be glad to send over there, but not you. For you, we had all these hopes. Why Alaska? Why you to this frontier, to this end of nowhere? But you know, Irkutsk was close to Kyakhta, where the fur trade with China was engineered. There was this one trading post in all of Russia where legally Russians could trade with the Chinese, and this is where the Alaskan furs were brought overland to Irkutsk and then south to Kyakhta and across the border, and this is where the center of commerce was. So all the promyshleniki for nearly 100 years had been bringing their goods through Irkutsk. And you couldn't sit around in a town square, a hotel, or a tavern in Irkutsk and not hear the stories from this exciting Wild East. We had the Wild West, they had the Wild East. And the similarities we've already pointed out. So this man had heard these stories. He'd grown up in Irkutsk. His father died, I think, when he was 4. He was raised by his uncle, who was the church starosta or sexton. And he'd gone into seminary, done very well, and now, all his life, you see, he'd wanted to see this country, the end of the empire, the far edge of the world. And with great reluctance, actually, both the bishop and his wife agreed. His wife, Catherine, they had a young daughter, Anna, already. And his mother-in-law joined the entourage because she had no one else to live with. This whole group went off to the Siberian coast, to Okhotsk, sailed from there to Petropavlovsk, sailed to Sitka, because that's where the boat was going. It missed Unalaska that year. And the following spring, in 1824, he arrived in Unalaska, having visited the colonial capital, which was only, what, 20 years old. There wasn't much to Sitka yet in those days. And he arrived at Unalaska, already having begun his study of the Unangan language. Because remember, Sitka was mostly an Aleut city. And he'd already met native Alaskans there, not just Tlingits, but Aleuts as well. So he arrived already intent on learning this language and developing a writing system and orthography for it. Mm-hmm. He spent years doing this with the assistance of an Aleut chief whose name is Ivan Pankov. Pankov's an interesting character. Every book that Veniaminov published, he gave credit to this Aleut man. We don't believe that he was of mixed ancestry, but he probably had a promyshlenik godfather. Dr. Lydia Black in Fairbanks posits that he probably went to Russia and spent some time in Russia itself because he was so perfectly fluent in Russian. But he was even more proficient in his own native language, in Unangan. And everything that Veniaminov translated, he had Pankov proofread, so that they were quite sure that it was intelligible and understandable and well-spelled, proofread and all the rest. And it took them 10 years. But they created an Aleut grammar, an Aleut primer for teaching people how to read, and they translated the Gospel of Matthew into Unangan. And they sent all these translations off to Europe to be published. Well, a few notes here. The Unangan language has sounds that don't exist in Russian. And St. Innocent, with a seminary, which is the equivalent of a high school diploma, accurately heard these sounds and did his best to write them down. For example, we have this sound in English. It's not the same as this and this. Because this is one phoneme. It comes out your nose when you say NG properly in English. But a Russian will say English. In-glish. They will say sing and ring instead of ring and sing. But Veniaminov heard this unusual sound, the NG, and the Russian letter for N looks like our capital H, and the letter G looks like something like a backward 7. Those are the Russian letters. So when it was appropriate to write this, Veniaminov invented the letter NG. In other words, his Unangan, and you can't even say Unangan without this letter, his Unangan translations not only were phonetically accurate, but they required special letters. You can imagine what it was like to be the printer who got the contract to publish the Aleut Gospel. It was not only a language no one had ever seen before, but it had all these special letters with little marks and squiggly lines over it because St. Innocent wanted to mark not only where the stress was, but variations in the tone or stress or pronunciation of the letter, much more accurately than we do in Russian or in English, actually. Well, it was quite a project, of course. The company was paying for it. It took over 3 years for the manuscripts to reach St. Petersburg, for the books to be printed, and then for all of it to come back. So it was 1834, 10 years almost exactly, from the time he arrived to the time the books were ready. So he could actually start his school. And he started the school in 1828, everything in manuscript form, but they were waiting for real textbooks so they could get serious about the teaching of the scriptures and also the teaching of the Aleut language. The books came back with so many mistakes, so many typographical errors, that St. Innocent and Ivan Pankov both considered the books useless, because almost every word was misspelled. You can imagine how frustrating that was after putting 10 years into this project. So it was at this point that Ioan Popov Vendyuminov requested permission after 10 years in the colony. It's time for a sabbatical leave. They asked permission for his wife and children, by now there were four of them, to return to Irkutsk, where three of the kids had never even seen their relatives or visited their native country, while Father John took a boat south to Australia, and then eastward to Cape Horn of Africa, and then to the Azores, and to England, and to Denmark, and finally into the Baltic, where he had never been before in his life. This is a Siberian boy. To sail to the printer, the print shop in St. Petersburg, and supervise the publication of his Aleut translations himself. So this is like a seven-month sea voyage, nearly more than halfway around the world, while his wife and kids headed off in another direction, overland to Irkutsk. By the time he arrived in 1840 in Irkutsk, word had reached the capital city that his wife had died in Irkutsk, in Siberia. The funeral, the burial, had happened months before. It wasn't a matter of getting on a jet and flying out there right away. But he knew his four children, young pre-adolescent kids and one teenager, were there alone with some relatives. They weren't completely out on the street, but his immediate impulse was to drop everything, forget the translations, and go to be with his kids. Tsar Nicholas I, on the other hand, heard that this famous Alaskan missionary was in town. Vendyuminov had not only written these Aleut texts, but he had compiled what he humbly enough called Notes on the Unalaska District, three volumes of a study of the flora, the fauna, the meteorology, the ethnic customs. It was a kind of encyclopedia of the Aleutian Islands, written, of course, in Russian and translated later into German. He received recognition as a scholar and a scientist from Western European schools and scientific academies later on in his life for this work. And the Tsar had heard that this famous missionary priest was in town. Bring him to the Winter Palace. I want to meet this guy. And Nicholas I interviewed him and was fascinated with all his tales of an end of the empire the Tsar himself would probably certainly never see, and expressed his condolences at the news of his wife's death. Father John said, yes, I intend to leave the capital soon and go back to be reunited to my children and take care of them. The Tsar said, please reconsider. We need men like you in Alaska. So I would hope that you would consider perhaps taking monastic vows, because you could be the bishop, you should be the bishop of this Diocese of Alaska. And I will personally scholarship your children to the best schools for which they qualify. Don't worry about your kids. It's time for them to be enrolled in schools here. And I'll take care of them pretty much out of my own imperial pocket. And you go back to Alaska and consider going back as Bishop of Alaska. We'll talk to the Holy Synod about that matter. So St. Innocent went off to Kiev, to Pechersky Lavra, the oldest, most venerable monastic community in Russia, and then to St. Sergius, Holy Trinity Lavra near Moscow, and prayed about this and accepted, with I think some reluctance, to become a monk. And at that point he was given the name Innocent, since there was already St. Innocent of Irkutsk, his hometown. Well, he was really from Anginskoye, but it's not very far from there. And Irkutsk is the place where he went to seminary and where his children were and where his wife had already been buried. So as this Siberian, of course, he was logically given the name Innocent in Inikenti. The Holy Synod approved the Tsar's proposal that he be made bishop. He was given the title of Bishop of New Archangelsk, which is Sitka, New Archangel. And crossing over land, he was reunited with his children and his family in Irkutsk. He prayed at his wife's grave and continued on to Sitka. Sitka was already in the process of building him a house. And if you go to Sitka, it's very important to visit what's called the Russian Bishop's House. It's a rather large building. It's two stories high and takes up a city block. But it wasn't only a mansion for an important ecclesial figure. It was designed to be the first Orthodox theological seminary in the New World. The whole first floor was dormitory and classroom space for students who would attend what was called the all-colonial school. St. Innocent had started a school at Unalaska, elementary up to middle school level. You could say kindergarten to eighth grade or so. The all-colonial school was intended to give educational possibilities to students from what we would consider senior high and junior college level, 6-year program. Native Alaskans were taught in their own languages, or at least given classes in those languages in every level. And the classes were not only theological, it wasn't only a theological school. It included classes in medicine, preparing people to be what would be the equivalent of health aides or paramedics today. Navigators for the company ships, cartographers, much of Alaska was not yet mapped, as well as singers, choir directors, deacons and priests for the Alaskan mission. All of this was going on on the first floor while the bishop lived upstairs. And half of his apartments were not his own living quarters after all. There was a chapel there, a chapel dedicated to the Annunciation of the Theotokos, and the staircase so that the students, especially those theological students, would go up and down the steps without going through the bishop's apartment. It's designed that way, it's all deliberate. So the first theological school in America opened in 1844 in Sitka, while St. Innocent, in the adjoining rooms, upstairs rooms, designed St. Michael's Cathedral. He not only designed the cathedral, he built the clock for the clock tower himself. His uncle, when he was a little boy, showed him the inner workings of watches, and he used to make watches and give them as gifts to his friends in grade school and seminary. And now he had the chance to build the biggest clock of his life, just a bigger replica of the same kind of thing, a clock that kept pretty good time, we're told, until the 1960s when the whole cathedral burned. The artwork for the cathedral was sent from Russia, and the Russian American Company itself and their employees, by personal donation and collective subscription, furnished the cathedral with its art. The original mitre given to St. Innocent at his consecration to the episcopate in Kazan Cathedral in St. Petersburg is in Sitka. The Mother of Pearl Cross, with which he gave his blessings those years in Sitka, is still in the Sitka Cathedral, as well as his personal Bibles, both in Russian and in Aleut. But while he was in Sitka, he started learning Tlingit, a nearly impossible task by most accounts. I have friends who have been studying Tlingit for 20 years and still have to check every sentence with their Tlingit spouses to make sure they didn't say something horribly wrong. Tlingit is like Navajo. You know, they used Navajo in the Second World War as a code that the Germans and Japanese could never crack because it's such a difficult and grammatically impossible language. So Tlingit is in that same family, distant relative. You remember we pointed it out on the map. And St. Innocent spoke Tlingit. He preached in Tlingit and spent 4 years evangelizing the Tlingit people. It's important, therefore, to say that he's not only the enlightener of the Aleuts, he's also the enlightener of the Tlingits. And in 1828, before he even went to either of the, before he really settled down in Unalaska, he visited Bristol Bay. There was a trading post on the Nushagak River here, and there in the river he baptized the first Yupik Eskimo converts. So St. Innocent is the first to visit the Yupik Eskimo and baptize them. The first, not the first priest, but the first successful missionary among the Tlingits. And of course the enlightener of the Aleuts, not only by confirming them in the Orthodox faith, but by opening schools for them. Yakov Netsvetov, a protege of his who finished seminary in 1826, just 2 years after Veniaminov. So there may have been a time when they even knew each other there in Siberia. Came with his Russian matushka, Anna Semyonov, to Atka in the Aleutian chain. It's this last island out here, on Alaska's here. They're not that far apart on our map, it's only a few hundred miles. But there's a dialectical shift from the Fox Islands to the Rat Islands. All of these groups of islands have animal names, depending on the animals that the Russians spotted first when they landed. So Atka is a small town now, but it was a major trading center in the time of St. Yakov. And he was given not only Atka, but all the rest of the Aleutian Islands and the Kurils. He opened a school at Atka using the Veniaminov books, and supplied the Veniaminov Pankov gospel with Atkin footnotes, so that even though there was a difference in language between the two regions, as he put it, we hope that eventually our people will all learn the same language, because he supplied the Unalaskan, the Fox Island translation, with Atkin footnotes. So wherever the text differed significantly and an Atkin might not have understood exactly what was meant, there was a footnote there to give the local variant. St. Yaakov, we believe, also translated the Gospels of Mark, Luke, and John and the Acts of the Apostles into Unangan in his spare time, spending 20 years at Atka. His Russian wife got sick after 3 years of marriage, was sent to Sitka, where she died and was buried. So as a bachelor, alone, Father Yaakov Nesvyatov labored most of his life, first in the Aleutian Islands. And then his good buddy and friend, Saint Innocent, said to him, I need a priest for the Yukon Delta. It's time we sent a missionary to the Eskimo people. I was there once myself about 20 years ago at the Nushagak, but we need someone to set up a parish in the Yukon, on the lower Yukon River, and you're the best guy I've got. Now, meanwhile, Nesvyatov, after putting in 20 years in the Aleutian Islands, had petitioned for retirement. He wasn't that old. He was pushing 50, but not quite. But he had put in 20 years in a very difficult area, and he had been alone. His house even burned down once in Atka. I mean, this poor man had a horrible time out there. It was his home region. It was with his own people, but he had a tremendously large territory to cover. He did a lot of educating, a lot of translating. His Gospels never got published, but they circulated in manuscript form among Unangan people for 100 years. St. Innocent said, no, 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 you can't retire. We need men like you. This sounds familiar. And I think you should go into this region. So Nesvyatov set up his missionary headquarters at a town that is now inappropriately called Russian Mission. I say inappropriately because there were almost never any Russians there. The trading post was operated by Aleuts. The church was built by Aleuts. And the people who worshiped there were Aleuts and Yupiks. There was once, for a few years, Father Hilarion from Russia was there for 3 years. And on this basis, the town is named Russian Mission. But I have always told people there that their village should be named Aleut Mission. For St. Yaakov Nesvyatov spent another 18 years on the Yukon Delta. And not only spent time sitting in that one village, but had to travel out to St. Michael's up here on the coastline just to pick up his mail. It only came once a year. And he had to go to St. Michael's down the Yukon River and out the mouth and out into the Bering Sea and wait for the once a year supply ship where the trade goods were delivered and the new furs taken out and all correspondence arrived. So every August or the early September, he'd go down the Yukon River in a kayak, paddle out to St. Michael's with a delegation from his home village and wait for the ship and hope that it would come early enough so they could get home before the river froze. One year they didn't make it. As they were coming up the Yukon River with this year's food supplies, sacks of flour and sugar and such, all his ecclesiastical supplies, his candles and everything else, the river froze up right in front of him. And he had to unload and go send people on foot ahead. They came back with dog sleds and they ferried everything back to Russian Mission. When you read stories like this, you think, and we complain when the mail is a couple days late. St. Yaakov lived for 7 years on the Yukon River without a church. The company gave him a tent to put up. He calls it the field church, but it's a tent. Anyone who lives in Alaska can appreciate what that means, especially through the winter. And after 6 or 7 years there, St. Yaakov is in bed approximately one-third of the time. He can hardly stand up. He has either rheumatism or arthritis. It's never diagnosed because there are no doctors there. He has no clinic to turn to, no one to whom even to write a complaint. After all, it's going to be 6 more months till the mail leaves, and another year before you get a reply. So keeping him in mind, you see, any time we feel a little bit uncomfortable, the furnace goes out, you know, and it's cold in church, and we say, well, we can't go because we might all get sick. Just think of St. Yaakov standing in his tent in the middle of February. What's extraordinary about St. Yaakov's life is that it was physically demanding. He died at the age of 60, and I think he was simply completely exhausted. And many years, we have his diaries. We have his diaries for almost every year he was a priest. This is what's extraordinary, you see. They took writing very seriously, and they kept very good records, those missionaries. Every day there's a notation about the weather to start with, how cold it is or how wet or how whatever. And then I had to bury so-and-so, or so-and-so was very sick, I had to take them communion, or so-and-so had gave birth to a child, I visited the house. Tomorrow is the baptism of such and such. There's some kind of activity, some kind of churchly activity almost every day. It's not the personal reminiscences and memoirs. It's what they did as pastors. But we have for St. Yaakov nearly all his Atkin years, 20 years, and we have nearly all 18 years of his Yukon career as well. And some of it is so extraordinary. I already told you about his freeze-up, the time when the boats got locked in the ice on the Yukon River, just trying to bring their supplies home.
This is the end of side one.